That was the last song for Ear Buddies. We're going to switch it up now and go to talk and music from a working class democratic socialist perspective, otherwise known as Socialist Alternative Radio. We are WMFO in Medford. That is WMFO in Medford. WFO Medford, WFO in Medford, also known as Tufts Freeform Commercial Free Community Based Radio. We're a little slice of that community based Socialist Alternative Radio is. We've been here about 12 years, I think, on the air. It's amazing how fast that's gone by with different hosts and I've been on the show the whole time. We've had different hosts and co-hosts and guest hosts and so on. And today, unfortunately, Diego couldn't make it to guest host with me, so I am alone here, but I'm used to that. That happens. The show must go on, and again, the show is Socialist Alternative Radio. If you're new to the show, we thank you for tuning in, first of all, either by going to WMFO.org and listening via computer, or if you're listening live, because we do go out over the air at 91.5 FM, around the Somerville Tufts, yeah, we emanate from Tufts University, Somerville, Medford, some parts of Greater Boston, some of the burbs, depending on, I don't know what carries radio signals best, certain type of wind or something. So that's our sort of area. But, you know, we do have international listeners via the internet, maybe. I don't know. We don't have any video capacity yet. Anyway, we are not just sort of alternative newsy, you know, like a lot of progressive shows are, bless their heart, and I'm not begrudging them that. They're sort of, their politics are usually kind of vaguely liberal or anarchisty or something, or liberal anarchisty or anarchisty liberal or something. We are not that at all. We are a socialist alternative radio, right? Democratic socialism, although that term is getting really dragged into the mud by certain people and turned into liberalism. So let's just say we are revolutionary socialists. Let's say we are Marxist. We see a need for a different economic system than capitalism. We see a need for the economy to be democratically controlled and run by working people around the world, coordinating together how best to produce things, what needs to be produced, how it should best be distributed. And that is what we're about. So again, we're not just doing the hey, alternative news thing, and if you get enough information, you'll just do the right thing, you know? Does that sound familiar? Sort of a new left approach. We don't do that. We think people need to be organized. People want to be organized. People like to be organized into things like unions and into things like left-wing political parties and hopefully getting interested in Socialist Alternative, which is an actual political party or organization in formation. And we are in political solidarity with the Committee for Workers International, which is many different socialist parties and groups around the world. So there's a socialist movement out there of which we're a part, and I'm a part. And you may not notice it. You may not hear about it. You may think it's just people running in the Democratic Party that call themselves socialist, which we can get into later. That is not what we're talking about. We're talking about, you know, real socialism in terms of political parties that do not get funding from big business, that whose goal is to have a socialist economy, you know, and a socialist society where everyone has enough to, you know, enough to survive or more flourish, not survive, enough to live on, of course, which a lot of people in the world don't, but including here in the U.S. But beyond that, a decent life for everybody, a fulfilled life, a life with a very short work week and work that we like and can control and work that is not so great, no matter what how you label it, you will share it out. We will share it out. We will get it done. In a social society, for example, where you're not producing for profit for a few, but for human need, you wouldn't have to fear automation. You know, automation could be a good thing because it would get rid of tasks that people, frankly, just don't want to do or could be done better by automation, which, by the way, is very exaggerated under capitalism, what automation can do or should do. But that's another story. So doing, but automation, instead of being a job killer and a disruptor of communities and lives and a polluting thing in many cases, automation could be a positive thing where controlled properly, decided on democratically by people directly affected, but even beyond that, in a general societal sense, in an area, even in a region or whatever, Do we want human jobs? Do we want automated jobs? Do we want a combination of both? It'll always be a combination of both, most likely, for as long as capitalism survives, even, or we survive under capitalism, which is a limited prospect by many accounts. If you're following environmental news and climate change and global warming and so on. By the way, just a little digressive rant. You have well-meaning, very interesting environmentalists, and I'm very interested in ecology and the environment myself personally, who will give these prognoses of well, hey, we've got 12 years before global warming is irreversible due to the carbon-based fossil fuel pollution of the environment, of the atmosphere. And so that's a pretty stark prediction. I bet if you asked a lot of those same climate scientists, are you a socialist? Are you in favor of democratic planning of the economy for sustainability, for human needs on a world scale? Because really, when you think about it, that's the only thing that's going to work. You can regulate the heck out of one economy and it's still going to be polluting like crazy, and then have 50 completely unregulated economies, nation-based economies, if you want to look at it that way, where people are consciously, where it's, they're consciously being used by the strongest capitalist countries via imperialistic intervention or whatever, like we're seeing in Venezuela. Like one of the first things, if this new guy, Guaido, the handpicked extreme right puppet of U.S. imperialism, if he gets in power, he's already said the first thing he's going to do is relax all the environmental laws, get rid of the environmental regulations in Venezuela so they can just start pumping out oil again without any U.S. restrictions, and sell it to their Yankee masters here in the big corporations, at cheap. Right now, they're not letting the Venezuelan economy sell much oil to the U.S. They're selling to other countries still. And imagine many different scenarios like Venezuela or even just completely compliant from the start countries that just, like it already does, capitalism will move into and set up extremely polluting industries like it does in Mexico or China and other places where the environmental laws are lax, and just pumps out the commodities they want to pump out despite whatever well-meaning regulations environmental movements get passed in some of the advanced capitalist countries, which, by the way, are flawed also. But so you get the point, really, that you can take the capitalism at all costs regulatory approach, even by people that should know better, the environmental scientists. They all should be socialists, basically. They all should be organizing working people to take power in worldwide in an organized way to get an economy that is sustainable but still provides for human life and animal life and plant life and everything. And that is possible. And yet they won't even think about it. They won't even touch it with a 10-foot pole. Some of them, I think they're Cold War babies, and they think that you can't talk about socialism without getting a blowback. And certainly that's probably true in their little academic niches or whatever, wherever they operate, or their governmental sinecures, if I'm saying that word correctly, where they will... they will risk something if they come out of socialists, but it's well worth the risk if you really believe 12 years and that's it, right? For the planet, for human habitation to degrade rapidly after that, the ability for humans to live on the planet to degrade rapidly after that 12-year mark, if you really believe in that. So if you really believe in cleaning up the environment, you should be a socialist immediately. Then we can get into the nuances, what kind of socialist, that kind of thing. But yeah, you should have to be for that basic bringing democracy into the economy so people can decide. Their decision won't be elect some person that's far away, not of their social class, that's some sort of millionaire or lawyer or something, a big lawyer, big academic or whatever, big businessman, like El Trumpo. These people are just, they exist in a world that's so far away from what 90%, 95%, 99% or more of the people in this country live in. But we don't understand that. We don't realize it, There's a lot of people sort of in the upper middle class that are, they've managed to eke out, some trappings of luxury, maybe a big house, maybe a big car or whatever. And they're clearly doing better than the bottom 90 or 85% or whatever. So they're willing to, you know, die by that. But yet a lot of studies are coming out. Again, I mentioned that book Squeezed before on the air recently. You might want to check that out. That's a person that has written a book studying. I forget the author's name. I'm sorry. I was going to bring it in. Instead, I brought in another book to talk about here. But anyway, this person is purposely studying not just the effects, the after effects of the Great Recession of 2008 in the United States, but focusing the study on actually upper middle class people, or people that are in the true sense of middle class, you know, that were owners of something, or people that were high income at least, or meant to be high income based on their academic credentials or whatever. And what's happening to those types of people through individual stories that are illustrative of many other similar stories, literally thousands or hundreds of thousands in the economy. And, you know, and so there's this perception in America, just to continue that digression for a second, there's a perception in America that people are better. We're all better off than we really are. It's hard to look at ourselves, I include myself in that, with a really clear, objective lens and say, wait a minute, I'm so much in debt. My job is so precarious. Whatever the case may be, you know, we just had this, you know, thing happen and we can't pay for it. No way. I'll give a quick example. In my family, we were able to scrounge money together to buy a used car as a second car, right? But with all our expenses and everything, as typical Americans living paycheck to paycheck, the car turned out to be a lemon very pretty quickly. We got the bad luck of the draw, as they say, with the used car thing. And at first our warranty covered it. We had to pay for that warranty, of course, that added cost to the car. And then things started to happen to it on a regular basis. Every 3 months, something big went wrong with this car, to the point where I was at one gas station just swearing openly. I couldn't believe it. I pulled out of the station without getting the thing fixed. So the car had all these little problems on it. They were big, big little problems, expensive problems, but you could still drive the car. But I had to pay about $800, which we didn't have. My family didn't have. We, you know, just four of us, two kids, me and my wife. And we were trying to, you know, survive. Here we are trying to survive, trying to put a little bit away for things like college and all that. And we're not succeeding, basically, like a lot of other people. And so all of a sudden we pay like almost $800 to keep this used car on the road, you know, because of our schedules and having kids and bringing them to places and stuff. It's very useful to have this second car, right? Because transportation sucks. We have none where we live, and it sucks in general. Mass transportation. I just took the commuter rail the other day. I can attest to that. I tried it out again. It's very, very expensive around here, around in Boston, and very, very slow and doesn't run much, and et cetera. Anyway, so back to the used car thing. It would have really helped to have the second used car. And at one point, you know, within the last year, we were driving around two very, very used cars that were just ready to go. And so this one, we got past inspection, and then we go to we bring it, and then it develops another problem. In other words, what I'm trying to say, within 3 months of paying $800, it develops another $800 to $1,000 something repair on it. So we just said, that's it. We're sitting in our driveway. We're down to one car, which is very difficult for our schedules. You know, that's how we started out. We did that for a year or two when we first had kids, and it's going to continue. And it's you know, rotten, basically. It's really too bad that the transportation system isn't usable for any real life scenarios. And you could say, well, why don't you live near, you know, Americans are big on their personal survival strategies. They all think they got it figured out. A lot of people, I'm not saying everyone's like this, but a lot of people are like, the minute you tell them a problem, instead of being in solidarity or empathy with you, they'll just say, well, why don't you try this or that? I did that, and look at me. And yeah, look at you. look how you're living. Look at your rotten pay, and look at how precarious your life is, you know, your job is, and all that kind of stuff. And I mean, I think sometimes I think the real beginning of understanding socialism or Marxism is the phrase, well, I got to get up and go to work. I got to go to work. Sorry, I got to go to work. There it is. Sorry, I got to go to work. You know, you're saying that to your kids. You're saying that to someone, your friends. You're saying that to your mom, who you got to take care of, or your dad, your older dad, or whatever. Sorry, I got to go to work. That's probably one of the biggest, probably, the, you know, after hello and whatever, one of the most used phrases in the American English language. Sorry, I got to go to work. Well, so how is that the beginning of understanding socialism, Marxism? Think about what you're saying you have to go. So you're not free. But this is supposed to be the land of the free, America, land of the free. Sorry, I got to go to work. I must go to work. I have to go to work. You're not free. You're what Marxists called what socialists called back in the day, a wage slave. You're a slave to earning that wage. And that's what living paycheck to paycheck means, or being close to that. You don't get that next check, then you're going to be homeless. You don't get that next check, then your kids lose something they really need. You don't get that next check, and you can't get something fixed, a car, something in your home, which we, by the way, have a lot of things in our house that need fixing and are not getting fixed ever, probably. So this is what if you want to know what socialism is about, start with, sorry, I got to go to work. Think about that phrase. How free are you if you got to go to work? You're not free. Now I can just see the wheels turning. A lot of people says, but people got to work. Of course they do. We all have to work. I would say, hey, listen, we all want to work. You say, everyone thinks they know lazy people, right? It's very hard to find a truly lazy person. And if they are lazy, it's because they're probably sick. A lot of things have happened in their life where they're morbidly obese, or they're ill constantly, or they're mentally ill or something, right? How many truly lazy people do you meet, even under capitalism, where it's a very coercive system? I don't blame someone trying to say, look, I can't stand this. I can't stand being exploited. I can't stand being used by big, rich people. I got to find a way out. And the way people find ways out, the start your own business model and all that just is a fantasy for most people, because you need capital to start that. So the way out, if it's crime, we don't agree with that. That's you're going to be hurting other working people most likely. If it's getting social welfare, there's hardly any in the United States to get, and if you get it, you're not going to be living much of a life, right? But again, some people get so sick and so messed up by the system that they need to be on disability or something. There's no running around that. I've seen people that I've known through extended family, or through just it being in, wherever I was living at the time, and through work or friends, who they know somebody on disability that's not outwardly handicapped or something, not outwardly having a physical problem, and yet they're on disability. Well, they're on disability because they have mental health issues that they just cannot hold a job for whatever reason, So the question is, do they just starve? Well, some do. Some people don't get disability. Many people in the United States, they end up homeless, and they do end up dying on the streets or starving. Everyone, well, what about those food pantries and all that? Well, check them out. Go check them out. Nothing against the people trying to do that, trying to help other people, but it's a Band-Aid trying to cover an open wound of gigantic proportions in the United States, of food insecurity. And you might not be starving, but if you have, as I have done at times, live, the only thing you can cut is food consumption and what kind of food you're eating, and you end up eating garbage, that's going to put a toll on your body and your mind. Eventually, you're going to pay for that. So basically, this I got to get up and go to work thing is people that just feel, even if they, in the next sentence, say they like their job, and America's free, and we're just the greatest country in the world, and all that. And you could be saying this in many different countries, not just America, of course, any capitalist country, but I'm just talking about here. I got to go to work. Sorry, I can't play with you right now. You say to your little daughter, I've actually done this many times, got to go to work. You say to your son, I got to go to work, I can't. It's like the Harry Chapin song, as corny as that is. You listen to that song, Cats in the Cradle or whatever. So people go to work, and because they have to, because the system is set up in a coercive, capitalism is a coercive system, existing every second of its existence on using, exploiting other people's labor and nature, and exploiting nature in order to make a few at the top super filthy, enormously rich. I was just talking yesterday about with someone about what it means to what a billion really means. Like, there's all these billionaires running around now in the United States and around the world. And the difference between a billion and a million mathematically is immense. It's enormous. You know, I mean, the ability, you can't spend $1 billion. I mean, you just really can't. An individual can't spend $1 billion. An institution, a corporation could, at least on paper, do that. But it's just an enormous, enormous amount of money. Even $1 million to, you know, with if you have a family and with inflation and everything, which supposedly is very low, but we know it isn't, right? If college costs have gone up 500-something percent in a very short amount of time, I forget the exact number of years, then you're not talking about low inflation, no matter what the government says. But so all these things people need, healthcare, education, things, that, you know, transportation, cars, whatever, inflation, boom, it's very, they're all very expensive now. And so people are in a situation where $1 million doesn't seem like that much, you know, it still is really, it's still a lot of money compared to what most people have, the vast, vast majority of people have in the United States. But you get stories, like, again, in this book, Squeezed, I was mentioning, you get stories of people that, wait a minute, wait, on paper, we're pulling in, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars, and we're not, but we're not getting that in our net pay, and we're, and after expenses and so on, we're wait a minute, we're precariously living as well. What's going on? So $1 million isn't the ticket to paradise like it used to be, but I would take it. I mean, it's not, but it's really not the, we're talking now, it's getting relative as the number of, as the economy gets squeezed, you actually see a smaller number of billionaires, to give you some of the math here, but you have more, that's because, you know, even in among the billionaire class, you have this, people that can't make it up there, they make it up there and they start sliding back down again. Now, again, we're not talking about sliding into homelessness, but we're talking about how the super rich are getting even super richer. That's what it means when the number of billionaires starts to get more concentrated. Then you have, you know, the super rich getting even super, super richer. And if we understood, if we really understood that math of what a billion is like, then this idea, like, as that has been floating around, by the way, prior to Ocasio-Cortez, of progressive taxation, which used to be like 90% on personal income or more, 1950s in the United States. I'm going back to those numbers. Lately, they've been kicking around 70%, which isn't enough. Then you would say, "Oh, wait a minute. If I'm a billionaire, I really understand what a billion is. That 90% taxation rate—that's nothing. Do it, you know." And instead, we've got most people in the United States, and it's not their fault necessarily, because the corporate media reports it this way ad nauseum, over and over and over again. Any taxing, raising taxes becomes a generic. All taxes must go up. If you do, if you use the phrase "raise taxes on any one individual," even I'll say, or let's say in one class, a one group of super billionaires, then you'll have the corporate media somehow convincing everybody, you know, and the capitalists convincing through the corporate media, convincing everyone that means your personal taxes as a worker must go up. Now, what's the objective basis for believing such a lie is that our taxes do go up all the time. Working people are taxed to death in the United States and get very little back to show for it. It all goes to the military, all goes to government subsidies for big business, you know, and then all the things people need, little trickle down, little bits of slices of that big tax pie, you know. So we got sales tax, we got, you know, there's people running around saying, well, right now it's mostly higher income people that pay income tax and other people don't pay income tax. Income tax is only one tax, understand. You have payroll taxes, Social Security taxes, all sorts of other taxes that come directly out of your paycheck under law if you're a worker in America. And if you're you have to pay them yourself if you're deemed an individual contractor, a subcontractor or whatever, or how do you say that? I forget the word. Individual contractor, subcontractor. And then if you're working for a check every 2 weeks or whatever they decide to pay you, you get tons taken out. Then you go out in the world and spend what little money you have, and you're getting taxed there too. So, and you're supposed to tip everybody as well, by the way. So it's death by a thousand cuts out in the real world here in the U.S. of A. And it's about, I got to get up and go to work. I don't have a choice. America's supposed to be about choices, all sorts of choices. Yeah, you have the choice of entering the I will sell my labor and be exploited market. If I can even do that, if they will allow me to, I mean, I'm getting to an age where, you know, age discrimination is palpably real. If I want to just get another job, it'd be very difficult, no matter what job I was applying for, no matter what my credentials. And, you know, the bosses really like that, the younger people to exploit, you know, in physical jobs, physically, but also in other jobs that aren't so physical. It's, you know, exploit mentally with long hours, doing more than you should be doing, you know, like, you know, if you're in a lot of jobs like mine, there's a, you're now doing a lot more than you used to because they've outsourced and laid people off and stuff. And then now there's a lower amount of staff. And some people would say, oh, you're lucky to have a job. Well, no, it's not luck. It's not luck. The big corporations don't make profits without us. You see, it's not luck at all. It's exploitation. It's using our labor, and then we don't control what we help create. We don't get back the full value of what we produce to keep that thing going, whatever that institution or corporation or whatever is, or the government or whatever. So it's not luck. It's not luck. It's going to be one of us. If you're thinking of it that just that way, yeah, someone's going to get a job. Someone else isn't, because they like to keep us hungry, like to keep us competing with each other. You know, like to keep, you know, they don't want to train people anymore. They want you to come in with certain credentials and all that, and they'll have people work faster and harder, fewer people, in order to make up for their lack of hiring or whatever. Or they'll outsource, subcontract, even if it costs them more money. They may do it to bust a union or something, or try to. And none of that is luck. None of that is luck. That is a deliberate corporate policies that are screwing us over. So we're not lucky to have a job. In case you haven't noticed, if you don't have a job or try to get one, you don't get any money, and you need money to survive. You say, well, it's just the way it is. Well, no, it hasn't always been that way. In U.S. in human society, capitalism is historically a fairly new system, a very destructive system. Yes, a system that's created enormous economies and technological improvements and so on, but it's outlived itself completely. And the cost of all that, as Marx said, in the transition from feudalism to capitalism, capitalism came into being dripping with mud and blood from every pore. Seeing capitalism as this monster that basically stole land, basically, either from, you know, native peoples, from colonization, and also through all sorts of wars of conquest from other countries, also from the feudal lords that controlled it. The new capitalist class took that land, or some of it, kept some of the lords lords and manors around, but took a lot of that land, took common lands that even under feudalism were considered common for the people, and took those, the enclosure laws and all that, took all the land it could. That's the mud part. And the blood part, of course, is, you know, the wars to bring capitalism into being, and to cement its power, and to then go out and through what's called imperialism, coming through economic and military might, go and enforce its rule after colonization, after either through direct colonization or imperialist rule, to secure cheap labor, markets, favorable trade, and control as much. And the United States is doing that, done that an incredible amount. But we're free, right? We're free. But there's a big cost to that freedom around the world. And it's not freedom, but it's a big cost to the illusion of freedom. As George Carlin said, if you believe in the American dream, wait a minute, I'm screwing up his line. This is a famous line by the late George Carlin, and also late in George Carlin's career, when he was just telling the brutal truth about the United States and about capitalism. You should check out some of his stuff. Check out his riff called Big Business. We can't play it on the air here, but it's masterful. It's just wonderful. He says it like it is. He didn't have any solutions, really. He's a bit of a nihilist, as far as I can tell. But he did tell the truth a lot. And so he said, what was it? They call it the American dream because you have to be asleep to believe it. Yeah, they call it the American dream because you have to be asleep to believe it. And that's exactly true. If you believe we're free as working people, when the environment is increasingly unstable, as you can just figure out yourself, and being polluted to hell by capitalism, basically, when you got to get up and go to work, even if you don't want to, and you're a wage slave, and your country in your name, and you might know people like I do, like I have, that go into the military because they pretty much have to, are out killing other people or enforcing governments that are unjust, you know? I mean, what if it's not a shooting war, but you have troops in the area supporting a dictator or whatever? You know, there's troops in, American troops, like 150 countries or something like that. So, and then you look around the world and you have in Saudi, I don't know if there's any American troops in Saudi Arabia right now, I kind of doubt it, but directly on the ground, but maybe there are. So you got Saudi Arabia, right? Theocratic dictatorship. You have Thailand right now is a military dictatorship. A lot of people don't know that, but true, very true. They're not talking about Thailand. They're talking about Venezuela, which is not a dictatorship, by the way. You could go down a list of countries with direct, you know, complete lack of even what's known as bourgeois or sort of capitalist democracy, meaning a very truncated democracy ruled by money, but at least there's some voting happening. You can go through and find places where that's not even happening, and then places where it's sort of happened, but it's very dicey and very tricky, that who's really in there, how they get there, and so on. And again, not Venezuela. And say, well, wait a minute, there's troops there enforcing that, and then there's troops in combat zones and so on. So the price of of the illusion of freedom is just not, it's not worth it. It's not right. It's not just. And part of the reason I'm getting into that is because we're going to talk about Venezuela today. And that is certainly an unjust situation that's been foisted upon the people there. We're going to take a quick musical interlude here, because we got to get something done technically here in the station. You are listening to Socialist Alternative Radio, talk and music from a working class democratic socialist perspective. Go to WMFO.org or at tell your friends to go to WMFO.org to listen via computer or listen live at 91.5 FM. So we're going to hit you with some New Model Army and be right back. We'll be right back.
mama looked at your children are playing in the street again. Don't you know what happened down there? A youth of 14 got shot down there. The cocaine guns are jammed downtown. The killing clowns, the blood money men, shooting for Washington bullets again. As every cell in Chile will tell the cries of the tortured men. Remember Allende and the days before, before the army came. Please remember Victor Jara in the Santiago Stadium. Es verdad, those Washington bullets again. And in the Bay of Pigs in 1961, Havana for the Playboy in the Cuban sun. For Castro is the color, is a redder than red. Those Washington bullets want Castro dead. For Castro is the color, the bullet you spray of lead. Moscow bullets missed. Ask him what he thinks of voting communist. Ask the Dalai Lama in the hills of Tibet. How many monks did the Chinese get in a war-torn swamp? Stop any mercenary and check the British bullets in his armory.
And that was The Clash with Washington Bullets again. It's actually, the song is entitled Washington Bullets, if you want to find it. It's from an album called Sandinista. And I bought it when it first came out years ago, 1980. And I was just learning about socialism at that time. I still am. I mean, something that it's, a, you know, the root of socialism is Marxism. And that's a methodology more than anything, a guide to a type of analysis and a guide to political action, and, you know, and so things have to be constantly rethought about, reanalyzed, because things are always changing. Although there are some constants, some threads, at, you know, in certain historical periods like we're living through now, that's still a very open-ended system of thinking and analyzing, contrary to its portrayal as being some sort of dogma by the class enemy, the capitalist class, and the super rich that are destroying the planet and using up our lives. And before that was New Model Army with Great Expectations. Really great song if you listen to it carefully. Brilliant lyrics, nice punk. beat and sound. And anyway, without getting too much into the influence of music on political development, especially here in the United States, with no mass workers party, no big socialist party, communist party, labor party, even one in decline, that we could say, well, at one point that was revolutionary, or at one point they came out with this party that broke free of big business. All we have is the Democratic Party and the Republican parties right now, and they're not even real political parties with memberships. They're just electoral machines controlled by capitalism, controlled by big money. And we desperately need and have needed a workers' party, even just like the NDP, the New Democratic Party in Canada, which is how they got national health care through the threat of the NDP as a new political party in 1964, making that their main program plank and threatening to take power from the established capitalist parties. And the NDP has never held power nationally in Canada, but there is national health care and a lot of other social welfare things in Canada. Things, that's a great word. Social welfare benefits in Canada that were won only because they, like other countries, or most countries around the world, there was some sort of party that, at least for a time, under capitalism, that was formed precisely to politically fight capitalism without using the money of capitalism in any way, you know? And some parties got powerful enough from the left that they forced government funding of elections. That's a tricky thing, in my opinion, but they did it. And that's through either government funding or raising money from the labor movement, or raising money directly as an independent party of being independent of capitalism. They are able to fund themselves. We could do that here in a second. But over and over again, well-meaning people, for the most part, just beat their heads against the wall of the Democratic Party, and they wanted to suddenly miraculously change into something that it never was or never will be. The Democratic Party, the party of the slave owners first, then the party of the capitalists. And while the party of the capitalists defended completely the end of Reconstruction and the implementation of Jim Crow in the South, right? That's the party you want to go in and reform? The party that right now you still have these people in Virginia, the governor, and in blackface and a Klan robe, possibly, and the other politician, I forget what his position is in Virginia, with a was discovered in blackface in some previous thing, and this is the party you want to be a part of and reform. AOC, BS, you know, so-called socialists who really aren't. And they're dragging people in the Democratic Party, and socialists that should know better, directing people to the Democratic Party, sowing illusions in the Democratic Party. If you support a Democratic Party candidate, you're supporting the Democratic Party. You cannot separate the individuals from the party. Look at AOC. She supported Pelosi. She's said she would support whatever Democratic Party candidate has emerged in the New York recent the elections last year in November 2017, and would support whoever ends up the Democratic Party nominee for president in this big where all these different candidates are vying for in the Democratic Party primary. We've talked about AOC in other shows. I don't want to get into that in much detail right now, but if you look closely at her record, especially on voting for war funding, Sanders on war funding and all that, they're horrible on imperialism. They might say something, but I don't see AOC and Sanders trying to organize any sort of movement against U.S. imperialist intervention in Venezuela. They have, as far as I remember, made statements against U.S. intervention, military intervention right now. I have to double check that, but I think I read lukewarm statements from both of them. However, Sanders is also the one that called Chavez when he came up in an interview or discussion in the last few years. He called Chavez a dead communist dictator. Well, he got the dead part right, but he wasn't a communist, really. And what if he was? You know, Sanders calls himself a socialist. Not true, by the way. He defines socialism as like the policies of Lyndon Johnson and Franklin Delano Roosevelt and the policies of the Scandinavian countries right now. Those are all not socialist policies. Those are pro-capitalist policies. Even Roosevelt was fond of saying, "I'm saving capitalism for you," to his right-wing critics. And so there's no, they're just objectively speaking, not at all socialist. Now socialism is becoming to be known, or democratic socialism is becoming to be known as any kind of government ownership of parts of the economy. So if parts of the economy are owned by the government, regardless of how they're managed, because right now, say Amtrak, owned by the U.S. government, you could have some right-wingers say that's a socialistic thing if they want to be accurate or something, or try to be. No, it's not, because they appoint big business people to run the thing, and they starve it to death in the capitalist legislature, you know, in the capitalist-dominated legislature. They starve Amtrak of funding. They charge money for it. If it was socialistic, truly it would be free. So anyway, when you talk about socialism, you can't separate it out from communism. Communism is the goal. It's one way to conceive it. There's other ways. Communism is the goal of a socialist society. Social society is the transition from capitalism to socialism, and you know, all the organizing and changes that need to be made away from private ownership of the means of production of big factories and farms and so on into the public ownership of the big corporations and the big and you know, people really controlling some sort of workers' government, very different from ours, much more democratic. And that's all socialism, because you still would have, you know, elements of the old system vying for power. Probably you would have you'd have to be spreading this internationally. You would have a lot of struggles, a lot of organizing to do under socialism to break from, still have a clean break from capitalism and set up an economy that can't be overrun by capitalism again, and a government that can't be overrun, and people that can't be overrun, frankly, by capitalism. Despite and it will be struggle. But what's your goal? If your goal is to stay at that level, AOC gave an interview on MSNBC where she said AOC, by the way, is Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. I'm sorry if I screwed up her first name, Alexandra or Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. She is getting a lot of media, and they call her a socialist. And even socialists that I know call her a socialist. Huge, huge mistake. She's not a socialist. She gave an interview on MSNBC recently, and she said that in response to a question, and it was a leading question, but she should, you know, be able to handle that. Leading question is, you know, by this obviously pro-capitalist MSNBC guy, can't you be a capitalist and a democratic socialist? She said, yes, you can be a capitalist and a democratic socialist. Well, that's completely not true, unless you're going to redefine democratic socialism, which I'm afraid is happening right now. You've got people that just can't handle, whether they're of the left or whether they're just liberals, they can't handle, they're so jarred, they're so taken aback and so rattled by Trump that they can't keep to the truth. They have to look for shortcuts. They have to be opportunist and go and try to get, try to agree, oh yeah, that's democratic socialism, because then the people around that won't hate us so much if we say, no, it's not democratic. They're not going to hate us. We can have a good discussion. We can have a debate. We can work on the same issues with AOC if she wants to go out in the street with us, right? But we don't have to lie. We don't have to say that someone that says you can be a democratic socialist and a capitalist is telling the truth. They're not telling the truth. They're misinformed about capitalism. Nothing personal, but you are misinformed. You cannot be those are completely opposite. You know, then she went on to basically talk about how, describe without using the term, a mixed economy would be the goal, her goal, as a self-proclaimed democratic socialist. She would want a mixed economy, basically. And the MSNBC guy loved it, because that's capitalism, you know, and that's what we have now in Venezuela, by the way, and what we had even under Chavez in Venezuela. And that's one reason why it can't work. You're either going to have capitalism or socialism. There's no mix. There's no mix, because the capitalists are always trying to claw back every corner of profit making they can. Capitalism is about profit mongering for the few. And they won't like, they don't even like Amtrak, for goodness sake. They control it because it's run like a business and business people are appointed to head it. And they can have the public ownership label on it. What that does, sometimes you have public ownership under capitalism, and the capitalists don't like that example, but they tolerate it because they don't want to come up with the capital to fill in the blank. You know? There are places in the United States where you have municipal utilities because the capitalists don't want to pay all the tons of money it costs to maintain an electrical grid, to maintain an infrastructure, to introduce new technologies like wind and solar and so on. They don't want to pay for that in a lot of cases. And if they haven't figured out how to make profit out of it, you know, they haven't figured out how to get that public utility into their hands and then start ratcheting up the bills like they do. on people. They might be a market that's already, hey, people can't afford it. They know people won't be able to pay the bills, you know? They know they can't come up with the startup capital. They're doing other things. Capitalism, while it is sort of trying to be everywhere, can't be everywhere. And there are places where, plenty of examples where capitalists get their greedy hands on what we used to think of as kind of public things, like utilities and transportation and so on, mass transportation and so on. Capitalists worm their way in and create ridiculous systems of redundancies and waste by trying to say, well, I own this train line, and the capitalist B owns that other train line, and you know, we'll see what happens. And so through the competition and so on, people think competition is good. No, there's no real competition there. They can both jack up the price incredibly. There's no one being, you can't go after Big Pharma now for price fixing. You can't go after anybody. And they're not really going after Big Pharma. They're putting on a show, really. But you have, you can just so easily fix prices under capitalism. So easily have what looks like competition is really just a higher form of monopolization, right? Like, you can say there's competition if there's two big corporations in the world. And that is competition, but it's at such a level, it's virtually monopolization, and the competition just results in a lot of waste and a lot of unnecessary advertising and waste and redundancy, where a government-controlled, workers' government, not the kind of government we have, capitalist government, a workers' government-controlled, integrated, worldwide, forget you don't even need corporations, just system, you know, that people democratically decide how it's going to function and where it's going to go and why and so on, that'd be a whole different ballgame, a whole different story. So you can't really have a mix. Whenever you have this sort of mixed economy, like I just played the song Sandinista by The Clash. That talks about the 1979 revolution of the Sandinista government. I'm sorry, the Sandinista movement in Nicaragua. And without getting into too much detail about how it was, not really socialist, they did try to take under public ownership a proportion of the economy, but that's the key, a portion. They took, like, I think it was 40% or maybe 60%. I have to double check on the figure, but either way, you're leaving a huge chunk of the economy in private hands. So that, coupled with the CIA and U.S. imperialism coming down under the Reagan administration, their lives, that Sandinista government was doomed to failure. You know, it was not going to survive unless it became part of an international movement, and even then a lot would have to change in terms of how it was trying to so-called construct socialism, by leaving such huge chunks that would have to change, leaving such huge chunks of the economy under private ownership. Private ownership of economic power translates directly into political power in a capitalist society. So you might think it's benign to leave, one might think it's benign based on capitalist propaganda and so on, to leave a section of the economy, a big section. I'm not talking about little small businesses. I'm talking about, medium, big to big business. Leave a section of the economy, say, road. Like not right now, most cities have privatized their, it seems to me like they have. I'd have to double check that figure, but it seems like a lot. Let's say a lot of cities have privatized their road maintenance, right? So you say, okay, under capitalism, in the transition to socialism and under socialism, we're going to let road maintenance stay in private hands. Well, I think people are going to say, wait a minute, we need roads. Roads are everywhere. Hopefully then, by then, if things go a certain way politically to the left, we might even be driving more electric vehicles and so on. Don't get me started on that, why people can't afford electric vehicles and how they could easily if it was subsidized in a much greater way. But let's say we're going to need roads, right? And roads cross boundaries. So why are you going to let a capitalist corporation either split up artificially, arbitrarily, what they're going to take care of in terms of road maintenance at a cost? And why should we pay that cost? And they're going to be exploiting the heck out of their workers in a society that's trying to shorten the work week and trying to make sure everybody has a decent life. It's going to be completely incompatible. And it's going to do a rotten job compared to what motivated workers. I mean, if you go back to the original premise we were talking about earlier in the show about if you have to get up and say, I got to go to work, you're not free, which is true, by the way. Think about it if you don't believe me. Then a lot of people would say, but people won't work unless they're forced to. Okay, well, think about that. That means you're agreeing with people should not be free. Because you're not free to choose your labor. choose when to work and how to work and so on, not just necessarily as an individual, but collectively. We don't even have that, anything close to that, but also even as an individual. So what would happen in a social society if you got rid of the coercive aspects of society or capitalism? That if you stopped working, you wouldn't starve. If you stopped working, you wouldn't be homeless. Would anybody work? Absolutely. Why would they work? Because they're motivated, unlike anything they ever experienced under capitalism, by a better life developing. The taste of real freedom. The shorter work week with no loss of living standards. In fact, increasing living standards. Things getting better will motivate people to work more. And I would argue, and I'm not trying to be metaphysical, I think it's accurate, I think it's physiological to a certain extent, that people do work. People must work. I see people under capitalism doing a lot of volunteer work. And I don't mean the cliched volunteer work. I'm helping with a soup kitchen, which, you know, is fine, you know, in some ways. I mean, like, helping family, taking care of people, helping each other out on the street. You know, this whole random act of kindness things. I see a lot of that stuff, you know. I've done some of that stuff, you know. So it's like people are not just, we're taught the people. Well, first of all, we're taught under capitalism of some sort of perverse Darwinism where survival of the fittest means everyone's always fighting each other for dominance. When survival of the fittest under Darwin, go back and read Darwin if you must, is about adapting to the ecosystem, basically. It's about adapting to the conditions of the environment. That adaptation might take the form of not fighting. It might take the form of cooperation. There's plenty of interspecies cooperation, even in nature. It might take the form of an evolution that even if it does have an element of killing another species, it's you're killing the sickness of that species. It's got a evolutionary reason to be that way. It's not pure. It's not evil. It's not like killing It's not like a conscious murder or something, you know? I'm having trouble explaining that clearly. That's a whole complex thing about ecology. But the point is that human beings competing with each other is actually quite rare compared to human beings cooperating with each other, being in solidarity, being in empathy. Now, capitalism can bring out the worst in people, and a subsection of the population is going to react the worst you can imagine. So I'm not saying there's no crime or no evil or no sick people out there, but they're that way for a reason. So under socialism, if it's really building on an international scale, especially, which it will have to, then the motivation to work becomes like the motivation that we have when we work for ourselves, quote unquote, for our families, for other people that we want to help. Multiply that times a huge amount of empathy and solidarity, you're praised for being in a union. You're praised for being in a revolutionary socialist party that's trying to make things better. You're praised for helping for free, supposedly. But what's not free? What seems to be pure volunteerism actually has a fine, good, interesting, positive effect on your personal life. And when you start to see that connection, which you can't under capitalism, because the capitalists steal what we do, they steal our labor, but if what you do comes back to you, right, in terms of maybe at first wages, higher wages, but more importantly in terms of a better life for you and your family, a future that's secure for your children, then you work. And you want to work. And then somebody that doesn't want to work, a throwback from the capitalist days where people get so twisted they can't work, or they get so twisted they, you know, you would call them lazy because they're not working as hard or something, whatever. Or they're working a crazy amount.